This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
It's a story of a World War II veteran named Yefim. He is fighting in the Soviet Army during World War II. And then we see him afterward from World War II until the beginning of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. He has something to hide about what happened to him during World War II, and he kind of proliferates a myth about what he did. And we find out along the way all the how different that myth is from reality. And he's forced to hide what happened to him because of Soviet politics.
Hi, everyone. This is AJ Woodhams, host of the War Books Podcast, where I interview today's best authors writing about war-related topics. Today, I am extremely excited to have on the show Sasha Vasilyuk for her new novel, Your Presence is Mandatory. Sasha was born in the Soviet Crimea and spent her childhood between Ukraine and Russia before immigrating to San Francisco at age 13. She has an MA in journalism from NYU, and her nonfiction has been published in the New York Times, Harper's Bazaar, the BBC, the Telegraph, and elsewhere, because I had to edit it down because there's so many places you've been published. How are you doing today, Sasha?
I am great. I'm about to fly out for my book tour. And so I'm excited to start my book tour off with this.
That is such a dream. As we were talking about before we started recording, I am writing a book, a novel myself, and it is nice to, like, you know, sit back and think about what my future book tour is going to look like. And it seems like such a pipe dream, but you're about to embark on it.
Yeah, you know, it seemed like a pipe dream for me also 2 years ago, and now here I am about to fly. Literally in 2 hours I go to the airport, and last night I barely slept because I,
sure,
like, yes, you're excited, but I don't know, the anxiety is pretty overwhelming, honestly.
What's the first stop?
I'm flying to LA Times Book Festival, or Festival of Books, I guess it's called, in LA, and doing, just hanging out for 3 days there. And then I go to New York for my actual book launch.
Oh, very cool. I always forget, I'm on the East Coast, I always forget that California is huge and you can't just, like, you know, drive 45 minutes to LA.
Right, walk to LA, no. Yeah. And I live in San Francisco, so.
Yeah. Well, again, like we were talking about before we started recording, so many reasons why I'm excited that you wrote this book. The novel I'm writing is a World War II novel, which takes place on the Eastern Front, which begins in June 1941, which we'll talk about. And I mean, this is just, there could not have been a book written that resonated more with me. And just so, and I feel like a lot of, I don't know how you feel about World War II fiction right now in general, and that a lot of it is, and this isn't a bad thing, a lot of it is maybe World War II romance or stories that are lean more towards that, although there is romance in your story. But it's not often that I feel like there's like a good World War II novel that is a little bit different. And I think yours really did a great job there. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, there's definitely a trend, and I wanted to avoid being part of the trend. Trend in sort of historical fiction written by women, written for women, and written typically about women. It's what's been selling. And honestly, you know, that world kind of revolves around that, I think, partly. And I think on the one hand, it's great that there's a lot more fiction written both about, you know, by women and about women generally, not just World War II. But I feel like we're almost like leaning too far that way. And I had a big chip on my shoulder. I'm a girl writing about a male soldier, right? Like I'm a girl who's never been to war. And yet I think it's very important. Like I think it shouldn't be about sort of, you know, what are the stories we have to tell and kind of like how all these women that we have to resurrect. I think, you know, if your character is interesting, it doesn't really matter what gender it is. And I think, yeah, leaning toward romance because people buy romance is, I don't know, that's just not how I was thinking
like
about
50% of all books sold, I think, are romance books.
Right, yeah. And like, just because I'm a girl doesn't mean I want to write about romance. I'm interested in other things.
Sure.
This is also based on a real story and my family. Yeah, well, and so,
can you, generally my first question is, I mean, I got ahead of myself because again, I like this topic, but my first question is just for the audience. Can you just tell us what your book is about?
Absolutely. So it's a story of a World War II veteran named Yefim. He is fighting in the Soviet Army during World War II. And then we see him afterward from World War II until the beginning of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. He has something to hide about what happened to him during World War II, and he kind of proliferates a myth about what he did. And we find out along the way all how different that myth is from reality. And he's forced to hide what happened to him because of Soviet politics. They sort of during World War II and afterward, Soviet regime really made certain types of people during the war. Basically, they treated them like traitors or even collaborators. And the main character, Yefim, kind of fell into that category. And so he was forced to hide it. So as we go along, the book switches timelines between World War II and the decades after the war. And most of World War II parts take place in Germany, and the post-war parts take place mostly in Ukraine, a little bit in Russia as well. And we see kind of what happens to his family while he's keeping this secret for many decades.
Yeah, well, let's start with maybe some history. Because I actually have a lot of questions about your background, and because it's really fascinating. But to give everybody some context, so your book starts chronologically the furthest back starts in June 1941 in the Baltics on the eve of the German invasion, which is such a fascinating. I really like that you start. Like I said, I've got my book where I'm starting there. And I love those moments to think about just like right before everything changed for the world. And that's like one of those moments. talk about what the Soviet army was doing in the Baltics right before the Germans invaded, and then talk about what your character has to navigate once the Germans do invade.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of debate still currently to this day about whether or not how much Stalin knew about Hitler's plans to invade. And the situation, as I portrayed in the book, is we have an artillery unit. They're stationed not on the border, but, you know, basically an hour walk from the border in the Baltics. Our main character, Yefim, is a young soldier. He's 18. And he's very eager to show himself, because there's kind of this duality where there's an expectation on the one hand that Hitler will attack. On the other hand, sort of no one believes it. And this is interesting, because that was a little bit hard for me to understand when I was researching. I kept wanting like a very specific answer. Like, did Stalin know that Hitler's about to attack? And when exactly? And why wasn't his army as prepared for it as it should have been, which is kind of the big question that remains to this day. Because when Hitler did attack, things did not go well for the Soviet army. And many, many people, like in the millions, were captured within weeks, days actually, in weeks. And so, yes, they're stationed on the border. And there's kind of this expectation that, like, they basically won't dare. That everybody knows that the Germans are right there, an hour away. And yet, no one can believe it. Like, who in their right mind would attack the great Soviet Union, right? So there's this, all this propaganda that was happening for a long time about that we're this unbeatable army. And, you know, even if they attack, we'll just crush them and revert them back, which is basically the opposite of what happened for a while. And it's interesting because, as I was saying, like, that was hard to navigate for me as a writer. But when we had the very exact same situation between Russia and Ukraine 2 years ago, and there's all these soldiers stationed right on the border, and no one believed that they would actually attack. Like Zelensky, you know, the president of Ukraine, was like, they just, like, on the one hand, he expected that they would. On the other hand, he was like, they couldn't. Like, there's no way. Like, this is just insane. Yeah. And I think that's actually very much what was happening in 1941 as well.
Now, your main character in the book, who I know is based on your grandfather, is he a soldierly type? Is he happy to be on the front? What kind of character is he?
He is excited to be on the front. He has four older brothers who all served in the military, and he has something to prove, right? He's this, like, young guy. All these, his oldest brother, Mikhail, came back with all these, you know, very proud of his service, and his mother was very proud of him. And so he has something to prove. And he is a little bit, he really believes in kind of the Soviet propaganda and in the might of the Soviet army. And he just kind of wants to kick ass. He, just like everyone else, completely underestimates the Germans and the blitzkrieg that's about to happen. And we see that play out very quickly, which is very reflective of real life. So as I was saying, the main character, Yefim, is based on my grandfather. And my grandfather never talked about the war in real life. The only reason I found out what happened to him during the war was because when he passed away, my family found a letter that he'd written, a confession letter that he'd addressed to the KGB. It's a short letter, but it describes kind of, you know, where he began the war, what unit, where he was stationed, and then what happened to him in the 4 years afterward. And when I went to research that unit, that artillery unit, I actually found this, like, handwritten document that unit basically was captured on day two of the war.
That's so, I mean, the fact that this is, I know you said it's loosely based in your family, but that is really incredible to me. And have you ever read the book City of Thieves by David Benioff?
Absolutely.
Which I love that book, but I was shocked to find out that his grandparents in that book did not exist. They were not real people. He made them up at the beginning, which is fine. I'm fine with that. But it is very fascinating when these stories have a little bit of truth to them. Talk a little bit more about the real grandfather, Yefim. I don't know if his name is Yefim, but talk a little bit about your grandfather and how he might differ a little bit from the character in your book.
Yeah, so my grandfather was this jolly guy. I mean, right, like, you know your grandparents kind of at a very specific age of their life, right? They're usually not working anymore. They're, right, kind of happy to hang out with you. Anyway, so I knew him as this jolly guy. He made really great lakis. He lived in Ukraine. And there were a couple of things I knew about his time in the war, one of which was that he had his two fingers of his right hand were damaged. So they were missing parts, basically. And obviously, you don't need to talk about it. I can see it, right? So it wasn't like I never really asked him about it, but it was this visible mark left from the war. And then he told me like a couple of little tidbits. One, something about eating an onion, and then something else about finding when he made it to Berlin at the very end, that he found all these German marks like lying around on the street because they were worthless. And those are like literally the three things I knew about his entire existence there. And I think it was very common. I mean, I think it's common here as well for that generation to not talk about the war, right? But so it's certainly very common in the Soviet Union.
Your grandfather, believed died in 2007. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
So you did have a relationship with him or not? Not
I
really
definitely
at all.
Did. Yeah. Okay. I visited him. They lived, he and my grandma lived in the Donbass, which is the eastern part of Ukraine. And I never lived there, but I visited every summer when I lived over there, like in Russia and Ukraine. And also even when I moved to America, I would fly back and see them. So yes, we definitely had a relationship. But it was something like, it was tacitly understood that I was not to ask about the war. And I really wanted to explore that idea in this book as well. Like, why do we keep things silent? And then what is the price of that on the people who aren't told, like on my generation and my parents' generation, who live with this like next to the silence, right? Anyway, but I didn't know anything about what happened to him during the war except for this letter. The letter is 2 pages long. It is written to the KGB, right? So like how much he's making up, I have no idea. It's written 40 years after the war. It's written in the 80s. So he's forgetting things as well. And I'm discovering it in another 30 years. Grandpa is dead and there's no one to ask to verify any of it, right?
Yeah.
So yes, the book is very much fictionalized, but the way I worked on it, I would take kind of facts from the letter and leave those as is in most cases when I could, and then research around it and then make up the rest, basically.
Now, that's great. I love that. How did you find out about this letter?
So the letter, we discovered it. I actually described it kind of pretty much how it happened in the book. In the first chapter, we open with the scene of Yefim's funeral. And then when his daughter and his wife are cleaning like his stuff from the room, they come across this letter and they're like, what's that? And then they start reading it. And it's such a huge shock because they realize that they did not know this man at all.
Yeah. And so in real life, when your family read that letter, what were some of the reactions that your family had?
What's interesting is that for the first, I would say, several months, my grandma and my aunt did not tell me about this letter. They didn't tell any of the grandkids. They were immediately very ashamed. That was like their first reaction was shock and shame. And shame is a big subject that I explore in the book, because our Yefim is, he becomes a prisoner of war pretty quickly in the book. And prisoners of war, unlike in America, were treated very differently in the Soviet Union. It was not a good thing to be, because sort of the logic behind it is that you spent time with the enemy, and even if you were in kept in camps or like worked, you know, as a forced laborer, it doesn't really matter because you were exposed to the enemy for a prolonged period of time. And so you could have been corrupted, A. And even if you weren't corrupted, you basically sat out the war. Like that's how it was always talked about. That's the verbiage that was used. And so were supposed to be ashamed.
In a point just about talking about the conditions of camp prisoners, a point you make in your book, not to give too much away for this book, but a scene earlier on is a scene where you've got Soviet prisoners who are very near to the Western prisoners of war, the French prisoners of war, and maybe I don't know if it's English, I think it was French, and you draw a contrast between these two, because the conditions are much worse for Soviet prisoners of war than they are for other prisoners of war. Talk a little bit about the history. This was such a terrible period of time where so many tragedies were going on globally and especially in Europe. Obviously the Holocaust. We really don't read too much fiction about Soviet prisoners of war during this time, which I'm really glad that you explored here. Talk a little bit about what it was like to be a Soviet prisoner of war.
So Soviet prisoners of war, I also knew nothing about them until I came across this letter and started researching the book. And I think that's very reflective of kind of how forgotten they became. In the West, nobody knows anything about them whatsoever. But even there, it's just not a subject that's ever covered in any way or talked about. But the stats are horrifying. So 5.7 million Soviet soldiers were captured, and more than half of them, so 3.2, were killed. They were killed in various ways. They were put in camps. A lot of them were captured very quickly. And so, partly the Germans maybe weren't prepared for it, but there's definitely documents that show that they deliberately wanted to destroy them. And while they were not typically put in gas chambers, which I think was happening later on in the war anyway, they were killed in other ways. They were starved, like purposefully given very, very low rations. And there's documentation about that this was done on purpose. There were diseases that were never treated. And the winter or the fall and winter of 41 was extremely cold. Even my grandpa in this short letter to the KGB mentions it. It was just really horribly cold in Europe then, and people were just dying from a combination of these diseases. And often, as I have in the book, often the Soviet camps were right next to POW camps from people who were not Soviet. And the conditions were like very much different, and they could see each other. So the Western POWs would get, the Red Cross would visit them and deliver boxes. You know, they had blankets, they had electricity, they had normal rations. They would play soccer. I mean, just incredibly different. And right next to them, there was this fence, and people were just dying by the thousands. They would also, at some point, the Germans just started shooting them, plain outright. And to my character also is Jewish, right? So he is doubly in trouble. They would seek out, from just general Soviet POWs, they would seek out Jews and political commissars. And often, another thing that was really shocking for me to discover, often it was their comrades that would give them up. usually for some sort of reward, you know, of bread or a bling, something. And yes, then in about November, when Hitler's invasion didn't go as quickly as he hoped, they realized that they now have all these of like millions of people being kept in all these camps, and they need help on the home front. They need labor. So in November, by which point, you know, tons of people had died, they decided to pick out the capable ones that weren't about to die and use them for labor in factories and farms and all kinds of places in occupied territories.
So do you know if your actual grandfather, do you know if that's the journey he took to Germany?
Yes.
That is the journey he took.
Yeah. So I based it on, you know, like the letter is basically like, I was here and then I was there and then I ran away and then I was there. And so I would take like all the facts that were in there, I basically took and used them. Yeah. They were just not very many.
I'm wondering, and I've never had the experience of writing about anything like this for my own family. I wonder, since this, you know, this actually happened to your grandfather, or, you know, large parts of it most likely happened. I wonder how you felt doing the research and how that changed your understanding of your grandfather.
Yeah. I think my understanding of my grandfather kind of changed as soon as I learned about the letter, I would say, dramatically, because I always thought he was this like war hero. That was kind of the myth that he propagated, that he was this war hero because he was in the war from day one until the very last day, which was very rare, given that Soviet Union lost 27 million people in this war. And then he'd say that, like, he had medals, but they were stolen on the train back. That was kind of the family myth. And when I learned that he was definitely not a war hero, he was captured so early, it immediately changed. Like, I felt so much pity. I felt so much empathy. I felt so much guilt, kind of for not letting him open up to us about it. And it was hard for me to understand, because I mean, I was born in Soviet Union, but, you know, it fell apart when I was pretty young. It was very hard for me to understand, like, the feelings behind it, that he must have, like, that internalized shame that you keep for your entire life. But the shame isn't fully, like, inborn. It's sort of given to you by your government. Like, the government is telling you to be ashamed, not like you actually feel bad. But also mixed with PTSD, which of course was not even a word, you know, in back then anywhere, but definitely not in Soviet Union. Just all of that mix of emotions is something that I wish I could ask him, you know, about, right? But my only way of processing it was to write a long novel, kind of exploring those feelings.
Yeah.
And, oh, I was going to also tell you a story. So about kind of the veracity of this book versus not. So at some mm-hmm. point, he mentions that he's captured and kept in a camp. And I'm desperately trying to find this camp, but this camp does not exist. Like, there's others that have remained, but this camp is, if you, you know, Google map it, it's like a field. And the only remnant of, you know, like thousands and thousands of people who were kept there is this, there's a forest. This is in Lithuania, a current day Lithuania. And there's a forest, and there's like a small stone monument that says that, you know, a bunch of Soviet soldiers are buried there. So that's all. That's all you can find on the internet. And kind of in research, I also didn't find very much about this particular camp. And I write almost the entire book, and all of a sudden I'm reading something and I see, like, basically like a footnote that mentions what seems like this camp. And it refers to another book that I didn't know about. And I'm like, oh my God, I have to find this other book. Like, this is it. This is the main source. And what I'm trying to find out is sort of like, what did this camp look like? Because I'd lived in Germany and in Poland, and I visited sort of like the big concentration camps, but the setup was different here often. And this was in the earlier days of the war. So it was just kind of a different situation. I wanted to be true to the facts, right? So I'm like, okay, this book, I'm going to go find this book. It's written by somebody who was there in this camp and apparently wrote a book. The book is published in German. I find the daughter of this guy who was long dead already, you know, and I try to ask the daughter for this book. And then I discover that I live in San Francisco, right? So I discover that the original manuscript, like handwritten, basically manuscript of this book is kept at Stanford, a 45-minute drive from my house. And I'm like, oh my God, I got so excited. And I set an appointment. It's in the archive library. So you have to set an appointment. I set an appointment. And on the day that I have to go, there's like a torrential downpour that's making news around the country. But I don't care. I am going to that library no matter what, if I have to risk my life. And I'm driving through literally like a river, you know, on the highway. But I make it to the library. I'm going to stop because there's too many crazy details. Anyway, I get to the library. They give me these special gloves because it's an old document. And I put them on and I open it. And I realized that this guy was in this camp for 3 days, and he literally just has two paragraphs he writes about it, and that's it.
Isn't that, you know,
I kind of wanted to strangle him, but and I realized I'm like, I can't write a whole chapter based, like, given that this is all the information I have. And so I put my main character in a different kind of camp. And I used only a couple of details, but the one detail that I did get out of this crazy trip that I took to Stanford was that there was no structures in this place. This was a field, and it was a very windy field, a sandy field, and it was very rainy because it was fall. And so people slept standing up under the rain, or they dug themselves, like with their hands, a hole in the sand, and often they would get buried there. Like they would fall asleep and just die in the sand. Yeah. And those are the details that I got from this research. Apparently, my grandfather was in this camp, with nothing, like a field, for 4 months, while this guy was there for 3 days. I cannot fathom it. I cannot imagine how one survives such a thing for 4 days. Yeah. 4 months, especially when it gets freezing, 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 and you have nothing on you, no clothes, no food, nothing. Yeah. So, and like that, once you understand that about somebody you knew, that they survived something like that, even though they were young and you knew them when they were an old man, it just, I don't know, like, the strength that takes, like both the physical strength but the mental strength that takes,
that
really changes how you look at somebody.
And you know, I've honestly, like, and it's a very difficult, as I'm sure you've learned, it's difficult to research because there's not so much material, but the materials I've seen from prisoner camp, Soviet POW camps, they're really, actually the Holocaust Museum has a lot of even video research of some of these camps. And like you just said, like they're open air camps, which is, you know, you're exposed to the elements, as you just said, like people are dying in holes, but it's just so gut wrenching to research, what was going on in those prisoner camps. One thing we haven't talked about yet actually is your grandmother, who really is pretty prominent in this story, the character who is based on your grandmother, Nina. Again, I don't know if that's her name in real life. Talk a little bit about your grandmother and the character versus your actual grandmother.
Yeah, I'll start with the character. So Nina is the first person we meet when the book begins, because Yefim dies in, I think, in the second page of the book as an old man. And she's also the person that we see at the very end, because she is the one who's witnessing the Russia-Ukraine conflict beginning in 2014 in the Donbas. And so she's kind of our, I don't know, she frames the book. She also appears in throughout, kind of in the middle. And the reason I wanted to, I kind of began the book more focused on Yefim's story. But then as I went, it became clear that his wife, Nina, is also very important, because she represents a different part of history. So she is Ukrainian, and Ukraine was occupied by the Nazis from 1941 until 1943. And a lot of people left Ukraine and went east, but a lot of people also remained. And she is an orphan. She's like a teenager, high school, college age during the war. And she has to live under German rule for 2 years. And afterward, basically everybody who lived under occupation got a little mark put on their documents that remained with them for the rest of their life, or at least for the rest of the Soviet Union's existence, that told anybody who would look at it, such as employers or people who might take you or not take you into a grad school program, that this person lived under German occupation, once again was exposed to, quote unquote, the enemy, once again can be possibly not trusted. Maybe they collaborated, maybe they slept with the enemy, you don't know. And so you are going to treat them basically as second-class citizen, even though it was not their fault that somebody invaded their country and they were forced to live under them, right? But the logic, the twisted logic of a totalitarian regime is such that its citizens privately have no control of like how their story is told and how they're treated. So Nina is this orphan. She works for the Germans because she has to eat. And she thinks about it later on in life as well. She enters university and becomes later on a paleontologist. And that part is true and based on my grandmother. She was quite a well-known paleontologist in her day. And she, my actual real grandmother, left a memoir. She lived longer, so I knew her, like, you know, although I began writing this book while she was still alive, but she was not very, coherent at that point. Anyway, but she wrote a memoir that was very helpful. Like, unlike my grandpa, who left me this short letter and nothing else, and like a big question, big mystery, she was very talkative, loved to tell stories, and had all these details that I don't think would have been possible to research at all, because she describes like what life was like in the Donbas, which is not like a sexy place that anyone writes about ever, when she moved there in the 50s, and kind of the smells and like how people talked, like the domestic environment, which is not something that historians like ever sort of care about, right? Living in communal apartments. She had an amazing memory. So there's just like all these details, like the popular jokes of the day, you know, like the what things cost, what was hard to get versus easy to get, just like amazing treasure trove of details. So I you know, plucked some stuff from there. It was also interesting to see like what people cared about, right? Because like I think often the American perception of Soviet Union is very like, if we close our eyes, we see this as like gray background and a long bread line. I feel like that's the image that people have of the Soviet Union, right? But that's not actually what life was like at all. It also doesn't necessarily reflect what people cared about day to day. So I have a chapter early on where there's an affair situation. And so there's like kind of the background of Soviet life in the 50s, but there's also this private private situation that can happen anytime, any place, right? And you're not going to think about the breadlines. You're going to think about the affair if you're the person living through this time, right? So I wanted to kind of bring those domestic details in there.
Now, I feel like, you know, of course, we were talking earlier about how, you know, your grandfather didn't talk about the war. And I think that's common with not just men in that generation, but probably women too. And, you know, I'm curious if you got your grandmother, did she open up at all about her relationship with your grandfather, about how much the war colored their experience, about maybe how his silence about the war really impacted her? Was she able to open up to you at all about that?
No. What's interesting about my grandma's memoir is that it does not talk about my grandpa as much as you would think, even though the woman was married to him for over 50 years.
But I'm sorry. Oh, so you didn't. So I saw this as maybe conversations with your grandmother. This is a written memoir where you got
is an actual written memoir. I have it. I keep it on my desk. It has her name on it.
So you weren't able to ask her like, hey, grandma, you know, tell me about grandpa or anything like that.
No, not really. No. And also when the Russia-Ukraine war began, like basically in front of my grandparents' apartment, it like that became the focus, and I wasn't writing this book yet. So yeah. I was asking her about those things and not like my grandpa as much. So that's, which is kind of liberating because, right, this is a work of fiction and, right, like I'm not trying to write the actual story of my grandparents. And so it gave me liberty to take their relationship and various ways.
Sure.
Like at some point I read that she mentions in the memoir that they went on vacation to Crimea, which I think was like a rare thing. And I don't know, she has like three sentences about it and mostly describing the scenery. And I'm like, oh, I can work with this. This can be a whole chapter they kind of like reconciliate and touch, you know, anyway, like a point in a marriage. Because in a lot of ways, this is a story of a family and a story of a marriage that's set against kind of a historical, complicated background with both of them are keeping secrets about their past and both of them are ashamed of different things in their past. And yes, I wanted to kind of play with that.
Well, I want to fast forward a little bit to modern day, kind of the Ukraine, Russia-Ukraine war conflict. And I want to actually read something that you wrote in a 2022 New York Times essay. And you write, and this was right after Russia invaded. As Russia's invasion began early on Thursday under the pretext of rescuing the eastern region of Donbass from Ukraine's military aggression, I knew my family has never asked to be rescued by Russia. For 8 years, this conflict has done nothing for my family except tear it apart. This is just the latest ugly chapter. Talk a little bit about that.
Absolutely. So the conflict began in the Donbas and specifically in the city of Donetsk, which is where half of my novel is set, in 2014. And what resulted from it very quickly, basically everybody who was, I don't know, under 50 left. Not everybody, but the majority of the younger generations left Donetsk. And by the time I visited it in 2016, so there were like shelling for 2 years by the time I got there. What I saw was, this is a city of 1 million people, just for context, right? So like a big city by American standards, which was peaceful, had lots of roses. It's like known for its roses, whatever. And it became this completely unrecognizable place where there was martial law. There were only older people, mostly women, on the streets. There were bullet holes everywhere, everywhere. There were, every apartment building had a sign that said bomb shelter with an arrow. There were soldiers everywhere. And at night, you heard shelling, like every night and during the day as well, during kind of rougher periods. And seeing that actually, I think, is what made me able to even start working on this book. Because, right, as I said earlier, yeah, I already had my grandfather's story, but I didn't have the confidence that I could write a war novel, especially a World War II novel. Like, it's such, you know, I don't know. And it's like almost a cliche. There's so much that's been written about it. It's so researched. Like, who needs another World War II book? And yet there were these incredible gaps in history that I discovered as I began writing it. But also, like, experiencing, if just getting that very tiny glimpse of what war feels like and the fear you feel when you hear shelling in your city and not on a movie screen. I came back from that experience changed, and I was like, okay, I think I can write a war book. And by then, my cousins and my little nephews have left the city and then became like internal refugees. There was, I think, about 1.7 million internal refugees from that earlier conflict. They were often actually not treated well by other Ukrainians. I think, as happens when a lot of people, when there's like an influx of people into a place, the people who already live in the place are like, ugh, who are these people raising our apartment rents, you know? So that was, they were having a lot of trouble. And interestingly, so my grandmother and my aunt and my uncle were the only people who remained in the Donbas, despite it being basically a war zone. And when I was begging my grandmother, who was 90 at the time, to leave, she would just basically laugh on the phone and be like, I survived the Nazis. Let them come and get me. I don't care. You know, she was just so done with all of it. And she would make up these like dirty poems about Putin in her spare, because all she did was just lie around and like listen to shelling. And but the family was torn apart because they couldn't see each other. So my aunt and uncle couldn't see their kids for a long time. Yeah. Travel became possible. It was very hard though. At some point, my uncle, I think, was visiting my cousin, so his son, and on the board, you get on this like bus and you have to cross this border. And at some point there was shooting and they had to like duck in a ditch. Like, that's how you see your son, you know? I mean, it was just amazing. And then of course this war began. My grandmother has already passed away, but my aunt and uncle finally, just literally less than a year ago, finally left the Donbas and moved to Kiev. And you know what it took? My aunt got cancer. Yeah. And that's literally what it took for her to finally leave her home. She was so attached to this place where she was born, where she has an apartment and, like, you know, a country house. But there's no water in the hospitals. I mean, the hospitals are like, you can't even call them hospitals at this point. So anyway, there's no medicine, of course. So she finally left and is now in Kiev. And meanwhile, my other cousin and like the nephews who were internal refugees once, now become refugees for the second time in their life. Like, they're not even out of high school yet. So just to survive that twice in your life is incredible, and are now in Europe. And I also have family in Russia who also are now refugeeing in Europe. So I have just no one left in Russia anymore, but several people left in Ukraine and a bunch of relatives in just various countries in Europe.
Now, I wonder, in writing a book like this, because of course the Russia-Ukraine war is the biggest conflict Europe has seen since World War II. I wonder how much writing this book, how much of it do you think has influenced how you're viewing the war right now? I think oftentimes, like, we'll hear, like, especially in historical fiction, often writers will, you're writing about the past because you have something you want to say about the present. Not that that's true for everybody, but I wonder what this period that you write about, what do you think that has to tell you, or all of us as the public and as your readers, what do you think it has to say about the war right now?
Unfortunately, the president of Russia is using history as a weapon to wage this war. So while it may not seem as related to the Western reader, these two wars are actually super in conversation with each other and have very much like a direct relationship. So what I feel like my grandfather was not unique in keeping, right? As we discussed, a lot of people from that generation did not talk about what happened to them. When you have an entire generation of people who don't talk about the truth of what happens to them, and you have a regime, a totalitarian regime, and now this new autocratic regime that has an agenda, and what you get as a result is kind of a vacuum of truth. So you get like state-written history that tells you what Soviet Union did or did not do, and how good we were, and skips out all the parts about mistreating its own citizens, for instance, among others. And you don't have private citizens who tell you the reality of their experience to contradict that narrative. You have a whole future generation, current generation of people who don't understand and don't know their history, and who can be easily deluded into thinking what their kind of national like story really is. And just to give you like a specific example, so Putin has written multiple laws that, for example, make this book unpublishable in Russia and make me unable to go there because I would probably be arrested. There's laws governing how World War II can and cannot be talked about that he wrote recently, like in the last 2 years of this war. If you go to like Soviet war memorials, you will often see in Russia right now, you will often see things or people actually buried, like soldiers who are fighting in Ukraine today. So if you go to like Victory Day parade, you will see people carrying their like grandfather's photos who fought in World War II. And you will also see people carrying portraits of soldiers who are dying right now. So they're very much like purposefully mixing these two ideas, because World War II was a huge national trauma, and it's very easy to turn national trauma into like a hurrah moment where like, well, we suffered, but we kicked the German ass. And if the West, you know, wagging its finger, like if the West tries something like that again, don't you worry, we're going to kick ass again. And that is basically the rhetoric that's like turning that's turning Russians against Ukrainian. They're kind of Ukrainian brothers.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, this book is like, sadly too relevant to today.
Yeah, that's so interesting you say that, because your book really is kind of a counterpoint to that narrative, because it is, you know, the huge trauma that, and shame, as you said, that comes from a war, and just I think a war in the scale of, you know, World War II, which the world has never seen such destruction and such suffering. And today to see that trauma trying to be buried, as you say, like it is in Russia right now, that's a very interesting point that you make. Well, I wonder, kind of lastly here, if, and this is probably pretty related to what you're just talking about, but if there's something you want readers to take away from this story, what would you like readers to take away?
I would like readers to know a couple of things. One is that democracy is easy to lose, easier than we think. That's kind of what we've observed happening in Russia. People didn't realize how bad things were until it was too late. So that's just kind of a general, you know, beware message. And I don't want this to sound political at all. It's just a general like warning. When something looks bad, it probably is, even though we like to think that it isn't. But secondarily is that private story. Like if you have grandparents, ask them stuff. America's also an empire, you know, it also has It's not a totalitarian regime by any means, of course, but I think empires generally tend to have like a certain narrative that they put out there that they want their citizens to believe. And I think it's important to know like the realities of private citizens who were there and who saw it and who aren't a textbook, who aren't written by, you know, people two generations later. So yeah, just value the private stories because they can tell you a lot more.
Oh, that's really great. I got to go ask my grandma some stuff after this talk.
Yeah, I so regret that I didn't. So yeah, please do.
Well, Sasha, if people want to stay in touch with what you're working on, are you on social media? How can people stay in touch with the work you're doing?
I am unfortunately on social media, yes. My name is unique enough. I'm going to spell it. Sasha, last name is VASILYUK. And if you Google that, basically I'm on everywhere. And I have a website. I do get published on things, and I hope to continue writing some op-eds and personal essays about all of the war stuff.
Really great. I hope you do too. And good luck on your book tour as well.
Thanks, AJ.
Well, Sasha Vasilyuk, your presence is mandatory. Go buy a copy. Go check it out from your library. What a fascinating story. And Sasha, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks so much, AJ. This was great.